From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The African Union has made a number of vital commitments on human rights and women's rights, including the Maputo Protocol on the rights of women, the African Charter on Democracy, Elections, and Governance, and the protocol creating the African Court on Human and People's Rights. I encourage you to make these the real by ratifying them where necessary.
That was UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon as he opened the 26th summit of the African Union Saturday.
I urge you to move on from setting standards to what I call the three I's: implementation, institution building, and investment. I repeat again, implementation, institution building, and investment in real change.
His comments were met with a strong response from the outgoing AU chief, Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe, whose words were, nevertheless, delivered in a collegial, even kindly tone.
All of us here are born out of the struggle for our elders. We were all, once upon a time, in colonies. All of us. I was just trying to turn over in my mind who of you, of us, came straight from an independent state to Addis Ababa. None. We were once, if not slaves, but servants of colonialists, servants of imperialists, colonized people, disadvantaged people. Today, yes, we may say, we are free, but our ancestors were not free. There are blacks across the Atlantic. There are others who lie deep down the sea. Skeletons have vanished. The oceans have worked on their skeletons. Our forefathers, as they were being dragged, going across. And across to a country where they labored, toiled, and died for. They are no better. There is Obama today, yes. What is he? What is he? A voice is made to speak their language, to act their act. What help is coming from them? Regime change. We are supposed to be free and independent, Mr. Ban Ki-moon. Supposed to be free, the 54 countries. We come to the United Nations, it's ceremonial. Every year, September, we are there. We pay lots of money to go there. And to the General Assembly, we make speeches, we go back home, year in, year out. But the bosses in the Security Council say, you shall never have the powers that we have as permanent members. And we have asked and asked and asked. And asked and asked. Reform, reform the Security Council. I want to tell you, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, you are a good man. You are a good man. But of course, we can't make you a fighter. That's not what your mission was. But you have done a good job for us. You have visited our countries. You have wept with us where disease has visited us, whether it was Ebola or some other, where calamities have occurred, where fights have taken place, where terrorism also has affected us. We thank you for that concern as a human being. And so that distinguishes you from others. Of course, you don't come from those countries. We know where you come from.
At a press conference on the summit sidelines Sunday, the UN Secretary General called on African heads of state to act collectively to avert more violence in Burundi.
I have been urging African leaders to speak and act in one voice. This is a matter of human dignity and human rights. The longer this situation continues, the more people will be killed and affected.
The AU apparently decided it would speak in one voice, but that voice did not speak the words that the Secretary General had hoped for. Rather, it decided against sending peacekeepers to Burundi after that country's government said that any such move would be considered an invasion. Smile Chirgui, the AU's Commissioner for Peace and Security, told a press conference at the summit Sunday that any deployment of troops would be deferred until permission was granted by Burundi's government. The decision was announced after a closed-door session Sunday at the summit. Meanwhile, China's foreign minister kicked off his latest tour of African nations with a stop in Malawi. Foreign Minister Wang Yi met with Malawi's president, Peter Mutharika, in Lilongwe to discuss how to align priority cooperation areas and projects. At a press conference after the meeting, China's foreign minister said his visit was aimed to help Africa keep growing economically, saying the path forward was outlined last month during the Johannesburg summit of the Forum on China-Africa Cooperation. Wang Yi also said that China's stake in Africa is now 100 times what it was a decade ago. Peace talks for Syria were off to a rocky start in Geneva.
We are here open to all discussions. We are here to engage in an indirect Syrian-Syrian dialogue without preconditions or foreign influence.
That was Syria's permanent representative to the UN, Bashar Ja'afari, who also heads the government's delegation to the talks. He said the group of militias that were assembled by Saudi Arabia in a meeting last month in Riyadh, whose delegation, headed by the Saudi-backed, U.S.-educated Salam al-Meslet, calls itself the High Negotiating Committee, were trying to disrupt the effort to find a solution to the crisis by placing preconditions. Press TV's Marzi Hashemi has more.
Jafari says the opposition is not serious in resolving the conflict that's been plaguing the country for more than 5 years. He said Damascus is determined to end the bloodshed and is open to unconditional dialogue with the opposition. Earlier, the Saudi-backed opposition said it's willing to join the UN brokered talks in Geneva. Meslet, however, highlighted the preconditions of the High Negotiations Committee, which has set for attending the talks. He said the HNC representatives discussed the terms with the UN Syria envoy, Stefan de Mistura, in a meeting on Sunday. De Mistura expressed optimism after the session with the 17-member opposition delegation. The HNC comprises a host of political and militant opponents of President Bashar al-Assad.
Danny Mackey is a Middle East analyst and the founder of Syrian Youth. He said the two sides are still very far apart.
Conspicuously, the first issue that should be worked on is the concept of trust between the two sides, because as you can see from the statements, many of them are quite far from each other. You've seen the opposition delegation state that they want preconditions and they want to impose their authority, if you like, on the talk before they actually sit down with the Syrian government delegation. As we can see, Bashar al-Jafari, the Syrian envoy to the United Nations, has already stated that he's willing to negotiate with the opposition on direct Syrian-related matters on a Syrian-to-Syrian level. This is something which the UN is trying to facilitate. However, both sides are still relatively far away from each other. And whilst the opposition maintain the stance that there has to be preconditions to any negotiations, this will ultimately hamper the peace talks because the government is not likely to accept such a condition.
The maneuvering around the peace talks in Syria was a topic of discussion in this past weekend's edition of CPR Sunday. Analysts Mark Sloboda and Eric Dratzer discussed some of the movement around the table and on the battlefield.
The big news this week is the conference, non-conference, that is happening, not happening in Geneva. That is peace talks, not peace talks. It has been rebranded Intra-Syria Dialogue, even though the Syrians actually aren't talking to each other. First of all, they're not even there yet because the opposition, only in the last few hours have they finally changed their position. And when I'm speaking the opposition, I mean the Riyadh-backed jihadists.
Right. I was going to say Riyadh, not Geneva, too.
The gaggle of jihadists with the FSA thrown in that was assembled in Riyadh and has sent people to Geneva under the title of the High Negotiation Committee, with one of the leaders, the chief spokesman, being from Jaish al-Islam, an outright terrorist organization, as Russia has spoken. But before we get to this farce, non-peace talks that people are not going to and they're not participating in, but they might listen. There was another event in Syria this week that I think is actually much more important if you look beneath the hood that has been kind of left under the media notice. There's a report in Reuters this week. Syria rebels splits deepen after failed merger with Al-Qaeda arm. Okay, first of all, what you have to notice there right away with the Reuters headline is that they are basically acknowledging that at least half of the rebels are Al-Qaeda, and right, they don't have a problem with that.
That's right.
All right, they're not even going with the pretense anymore. The other arm that they're talking about is Ahrar al-Sham, which is an Al-Qaeda offshoot that doesn't get along with Al-Qaeda anymore. They attempted to merge these together this week, and this is something I've been talking about for a while.
Yep.
There has been an attempt over the last year and a half, out of the U.S. neocon circuits, particularly Brookings, and I'm looking at Charles Lister, they're funded by Qatar, to rebrand the Ahrar al-Sham, this horrible, awful Salafist jihadist, head-chopping gaggle of people that want to impose the strictest Sharia across Syria and would outright execute or ethnically cleanse all the Christians, Alawites, Shia, and everything else, to rebrand them as moderates, right? As something that has to be part of the political transition. And in a way, I mean, this actually makes some sense because after ISIS, they are the largest territorial holder, in Syria. And the third one is literally Al-Qaeda itself, Jabhat al-Nusra. So, I mean, this is what the opposition, this is what the rebels really are.
Well,
now, there's been a let me just finish there.
Yeah.
Al-Nusra is officially recognized as Al-Qaeda and a terrorist organization by both the United States, which they're regretting now, right, and the United Nations. And there's a Security Council resolution,
right,
calling for the eradication of them, along with ISIS, right, and anyone who associates with them.
That's right.
Which, of course, includes not only Ahrar al-Sham, but the so-called almost vanishing Free Syrian Army, which fights with them, operates under their military command in the Joint Operations Room, and has become little bit more than the designated toeholders of Al-Qaeda. So there's an attempt to merge Al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, back into its offshoot, Ahrar al-Sham, so that we can pretend that Al-Qaeda has just vanished. We can whitewash them, and say that Ahrar al-Sham are moderates and bring them into the political transition. This is, in effect, turning over the Syrian government to al-Qaeda.
Right.
I mean, of course, the U.S. imagines that at the end of all these negotiations, their hand-picked group of liberal proxies that have been living in Istanbul or Arlington, right, you know, will be at the top. But this is what they seriously intend to do, because if they don't, then they have to allow what is the vast majority of the rebel force to be slaughtered after any theoretical political transition. They might even have to take a hand in it, and that would be extremely hashtag awkward.
Thank you for the hashtag. That helped. That helped accentuate the point. I agree pretty much with everything Mark said. The only caveat I wanted to add there and forgive me for trying to intrude on your point there. I just wanted to add that one of the things that I find particularly interesting about this rebranding effort is that it's not even simply for the purposes of public relations.
No, not at all.
It is because of the reality on the battlefield over the last few years,
exactly.
Specifically in regards to how many of the smaller factions, regional, even, you know, town specific, city specific, how many of those have folded into these larger organizations. So when we look at Ahrar al-Sham, it's not simply that Ahrar al-Sham, you know, it burst onto the scene in its fully formed, structure that we see today. Ahrar al-Sham has grown significantly over the last couple of years by swallowing up a bunch of smaller groups, by, purchasing weapons from, you know, various FSA, so-called FSA factions, by, you know, welcoming them, by paying them, all of these things. So all of these groups have gotten folded into
because of the unlimited stream of money coming to them from Saudi.
Of course, yeah. Well, the stream of money coming from Saudi Arabia, specific to Ahrar al-Sham, and then also, of course, the U.S. Weapons that have been sent over the border in Turkey. I mean, I always point it out, but I think it's important. June 2012, New York Times headline, CIA said to steer arms to Syria rebels in Turkey. Now, all of this tells you that the weapons, the money, all of these things, it's like trickle up, you know, it's trickle up destabilization, trickle up proxy war, because they knew from the very beginning where that money and where those weapons were going to go. But they needed a way to be able to justify arming and financing the straight up al-Qaeda and ISIS elements that we're now talking about. And one of the ways that they've done that is through this folding in of smaller factions into groups like Ahrar al-Sham. And that's what allows Saudi Arabia to have this kind of a convocation in Riyadh in December and to be able to organize this in this sort of structure. So I think that point is important. The other thing I want to say in regards to Geneva 3, it's actually quite interesting.
No, we can't use Geneva 3 because that's bad. That would indicate the failure of Geneva 1 and 2. And
right.
Said, not allowed to refer to it as Geneva 3. It is the intra-Syrian dialogue that the Syrians have to be, talking to each other, but
Geneva 3. Can we do that? I don't know. Anyway, the question that I have is, what's his name? Stefan de Mistura has sort of created a structure that is significantly different from the previous two dialogues. And this structure is supposed to be, I guess, what he calls parallel track dialogues or something like that, where the two main factions, meaning the Syrian government and, the rebel opposition,
Salafi style.
Yeah. That these two factions are not going to be in the same room. They're not going to be sitting across the table from each other. They're going to be speaking through intermediaries, structure based around working groups and these various other ways that he's doing.
De Mistura called it what? He had a term of art for that, the way they're doing it.
I don't know. I remember something about parallel track dialogue or something.
Something like serial consultation or parallel consultation.
Well, whoever, whatever.
It's like the little the kid in high school that's your friend that runs in between you and your would-be girlfriend to exchange messages, but you can't, you know, you can't ask her things directly yourself or something.
Or the kid who goes from one social circle to the next and thinks that he's friends with everybody, but everybody laughs at him.
Right when they leave.
Let's be clear. The Syrian government has said they're coming not to negotiate, but they'll listen. The opposition, which had refused to come, and Ahrar al-Sham is not there, they refused to come. Al-Nusra and ISIS were never invited. But what's left of the opposition, assembled by Riyadh, they say finally that they're coming, only in the last few hours. But they're not there to negotiate either. They'll participate.
Everybody's saying that. All the sides are saying that, and nobody really believes that a substantive negotiation is going to happen here. I think that from Mistura's perspective, and I'm not buying this, but just from his perspective, I think that what he believes is let's establish these contacts, these channels of communication, and a framework for dialogue, and the next time maybe we'll have some kind of dialogue. But all of this is BS anyway. The reality is what Mark and I were talking about, and Don, of course, what we were all talking about months ago, and even up to, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, where Mark and I had a bit of a disagreement about what the end game here is. Ultimately, all sides are trying to create the conditions on the battlefield in order to translate that into leverage in negotiations. That's the Russian, Syrian, and assorted Kurdish allies, along with the various other elements that are on that side of the conflict. On one side, the U.S. proxies, the terror groups, all of the rest of them on the other side. All of them are trying to do the same thing because, as I've argued for quite a long time, all of them understand that ultimately this is going to come down to a negotiated settlement. That Russia has said that many times from the very beginning. What they're trying to do, what the Russians are trying to do, is put the pieces in place on the battlefield and politically to be able to prevent the U.S. from dominating this process. That is really this sort of political jockeying that's going on here. And I think one of the major developments that illustrates that has to do with what we've heard about the Kurds and Kurdish-Russian relations and the increasing closeness of Russia and the YPG, right? That is, I think, a very significant element because aside from the two factions, the two major factions, the Kurds have been not
completely left. They've been completely left out of the negotiations.
They've been completely left out of the negotiations formally, but that's assuming that anybody believes these are negotiations. The Kurds were not allowed to be formally invited because of the United States, but obviously that's the United States doing that on behalf of Turkey.
And the Saudis too.
But from my perspective, though, the fact that the Kurds are going to be involved in this as quote unquote observers or whatever, or dialogue partners or something like that, that illustrates how much clout Russia now has in putting this whole thing together. Russia backed off from their original list of people that they wanted. They conceded certain people weren't going to be included. That was a concession I think they made strategically, but ultimately that's what this is about. And militarily, I just want to make one final point. I don't want to go on too long. Militarily, the question has to do with Kurdish offensive along the Turkish border, because the Kurds want to secure the entire Kurdish region of Syria and the Turkish border. That offensive, Turkey is already on record. I don't remember if it was Erdogan, Davutoglu, or which of them said on record that if the Kurds do that, Turkey will outright invade Syria. Now, they've done it already before with small incursions, but the language that they use said if the the Kurds do that, Turkey invades. If Turkey invades and goes to slaughter the Kurds, what do you think Russia has to do at that point? This is a very dangerous moment for Turkey, and the U.S. are really pushing the envelope, and I think that translates into what's happening in Geneva and why the Kurds are there and why the Russians have as much influence as they do.
Yeah, that's the Kurds have been saying, the chatter is that there is an extremely large offensive meant to close off this Jarablus corridor coming from the Kurds in the next week or two. And if it does happen, you know, we've heard this before, we haven't seen it materialize, but if it does happen, it will be huge. All eyes will be on Erdogan to see what he does. It is obvious that they will not have U.S. support, because Biden went to Turkey last week and he was dissing all over the Kurds, right? Making clear that U.S. support is with the Erdogan regime in Turkey, which just opens up the Kurds even more for Russia. But I would expect not only them to be supplied by Russia, but to have close air Russian close air support if they do engage in this. It could potentially be game changing. So watch the Turkish Syrian border and see what the Kurds are doing over the next week. You can amuse yourself by what's happening in Geneva if you wish. But as Eric has said, none of this matters. Iran and Saudi are not ready for peace. Russia and Syria are not ready for peace. Baathists and terrorists are not ready for peace. And there will be a political solution at some point. But as the Washington Post pointed out last week, Russian airstrikes have been too effective. And because of that, the talks are in jeopardy. And what they mean by that is the position of the Syrian government and Russia right now is too strong. And whatever terms that the U.S. Saudi could and Turkey could get, respective of the current state of the battlefield, is not something they're willing to accept. So we won't see any serious peace efforts for another year, two, three, or four years down the line, when the other side has been thoroughly demolished on the battlefield. Most important for that is the closing off of the supply lines north of Aleppo, the Syrian-Turkish border, and we see the Syrian Arab Army doing the same in the south as they're seriously threatening jihad, U.S.-backed CIA proxy jihadist supply lines coming up from Jordan, where they have a military operations center, or MOM, that they hand out weapons and paychecks, just like they have a similar one in the north with Turkey. That is where we'll see serious peace negotiations pick off, only when the game has already been decided on the battlefield. And then there will be some semblance of a transitional government ascended. The Kurds will have a much larger role in any future in the future Syrian state. The Baathist party will continue to dominate Syrian politics, and we will see Syrian Sunni Salafist representation, but only the ones that have the intelligence to lay down their weapons at some point, because the rest of them will be fertilizer across the plains of Syria.
What about the prospect of essentially Russian air support for the Kurds facing off against NATO Turkish troops?
Yeah, crazy, huh?
Well, that's the danger. I mean, that's precisely the danger, because and quite frankly, I think that well, I hope at least that people in Washington at least recognize to some degree the danger of that. And I know the Russians do. I mean, the Russians have repeatedly stated they want to take all precautions not to have some kind of an incident between the United States directly and Russia. Now, a couple of interesting things that I've noted in the last few days. If anybody saw, there was I think it was Washington Post, although I could be definitely wrong about that, but there was a report from some military experts, military analysts, who said that contrary to U.S. bluster and propaganda, Russia is by no means at a, you know, at its critical threshold for what it's for its operations in Syria. In other words, that Russia has a has far more that it could be doing, and that it could do this essentially in perpetuity. It could do it for as long as it needs to.
The Pentagon is really, really impressed and scared by the Russian air campaign.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.